and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Jessie. And in episode 3, we talk for the first time about a fantasy-adjacent book, Ship It, by Britta London.
So here's a brief plot summary of what happens in Ship It. Claire is an outcast in her small Idaho town, but her fanfiction about the show Demon Heart attracts a lot of attention online from other fans. An interaction at a convention brings Claire into Demon Heart's inner circle, and she attempts to make her slash fic canon.
Initial reactions. I initially kept comparing this book to Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell, which you haven't read.
Nope.
Kelly hasn't read it yet. She will eventually because it's fantastic. But they're pretty different books, and I love them both, and this one was fantastic. The fanfic parts reminded me of Vampire Diaries, which is a show I really loved until like the last two seasons.
Which I also haven't seen.
What?
Nope.
Okay, you should just watch seasons like 1 through 5.
Okay, great.
They're great. You'll love it.
I'll get on that.
There's a very Rhysand character.
Perfect.
Yeah. So yeah, Ship It was great, and I love it. And I also love Britta London because she writes for a show I love called Riverdale.
Which is amazing. Yeah. I'm not done with season 2. I need to finish it before season 3 comes out.
Yeah.
I adored this book, which it kind of snuck up on me, I think. I wasn't really expecting it when I picked it up when Jesse suggested that we read it. And I also wasn't expecting to fucking weep so much.
A lot of crying in this book.
But it was so cathartic. It was so good.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
Like, it's not bad.
No.
It was beautiful. Beautiful tears.
And this is the first book that we read together. I know we read it before we started doing the podcasting, but it was, like, very timely for us getting ready to start doing this.
Totally.
Which was also, like, you know, like, hit you right in the heart.
Totally heartwarming.
Exactly. So, yeah, I really liked it. Kelly liked it. It's great.
Our segments are a little off because this is fantasy adjacent and not technically fantasy.
Yes.
So we're calling this segment Fandom Ramblings. The descriptions of time spent alone during adolescence really resonated with me. For example, in the scene where Tess is opening up to Claire about how important her first fandom, the Jonas Brothers, was for her, Claire's inner monologue responds, this is a quote, "She could be describing any number of my own summers in Pine Bluff, not going out, just diving inward into my own brain, into my own computer, into my fandom." Whew. Gets me.
Yeah.
I did that, but with books.
Yeah, same. I would get in trouble for reading as a kid because I would like I wouldn't go outside and play. I just wanted to be inside and read books. And when I was forced to go outside, I would take my books with me and just read instead of doing anything else.
I also read a lot, and I listened to Harry Potter books on cassette tape.
Also had them on cassette tape.
And knitted and made beaded stuff and latch hooked. This is like throwback. If anyone remembers what latch hook is. Yeah, I did a lot of crafts, but alone, listening to Harry Potter over and over and over again.
Which is funny because it's what I do now, is listen to audiobooks and knit or crochet.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so I was kind of like Tess in this. For all the people I told I couldn't do stuff because my mom told me I couldn't, that was a lie. I was reading books. She's never said no to me going anywhere.
I used the same excuse. I totally did.
My mom said I couldn't go. I just really wanted to finish a book.
Sorry, not sorry.
Not sorry at all.
Ship It also has what struck me as really prescient discussions of how fandom works, and for both the good and bad. One quote that I liked was this: "I guess every fandom has its own set of insider politics and identity markers," from page 347. What do you think about that?
I think I agree. It's hard because I don't think I participated in a lot of fandom things. Like, I would go to the Midnight Harry Potter stuff, and Harry Potter spans like so many different kinds of people. But I mean, you have your Gryffindors and your Ravenclaws and, like, you know, Hufflepuffs and Slytherins, and they all kind of break off into their groups a little bit. But I don't think I participated in that many fandom-y things.
Not online. I didn't do that. It was more just like me alone.
Right. Especially because probably when you were a kid too, like, we didn't have internet in my house when I started reading Harry Potter, or even when it not until like it was super, super popular, and probably not till book five.
I think I started reading Harry Potter when I was 7 or 8. Yeah. So I wasn't using the internet really.
Yeah. I started using it when I was 8. That was 1998. So like we had internet at school, but that was it. So I didn't like participate in those kind of things.
Yeah,
like,
and I wasn't. And I didn't write fan fiction.
No, I didn't. I didn't even start reading fan fiction until like 3 years ago.
Yeah, I didn't really get into it during that time. And I think I probably would have really liked it.
I don't think I knew it existed.
I don't think so. I don't think I knew that either. I think if I had, I would have probably felt a little less lonely.
Right. I do remember, like, as a child trying to write a story that was so similar to Harry Potter that now, like, no one could publish that and even pretend that it was
not any Harry Potter.
Yeah, exactly.
Fanfic.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think, especially when you think of, like, I was really into My Chemical Romance in high school, and when you think about music politics and how those, like, quote-unquote fandoms work, this is really true, because you get the cool kids and like the older kids and like the kids who are like, I liked it before it was cool. And because I was on the internet in those times when like My Chemical Romance was really popular, you did see the politics of music.
Yeah, because I mean, just because this book isn't necessarily talking about literary fandom, it's talking about a show,
right?
So I think that the connection to the music fandom is totally appropriate. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I wonder if you see this, because I've never been to Comic-Con or anything like that before. Maybe next year.
Next year you're totally coming.
Let's do it. I wonder if you see this with, like, Sherlock fandoms and Doctor Who and Game of Thrones. I wonder if there's more fan fiction and, like, politicalized fandoms than I even realize exist.
I think that a lot of them are, especially with Doctor Who, you could get, like, all into the conversations about Jodie Whittaker as right. The first woman being a doctor.
I've never watched Doctor Who, but I'm gonna start.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, well, anyways, fandoms are kind of, yeah, they're very political, and there's different groups in them.
And there's just a lot of, especially online, like, infighting.
Well, and online's hard, too, because you're not with someone face-to-face, so it's so much easier, I think, for people to say, like, the worst things possible.
Absolutely.
That's why I don't get involved in that stuff.
I'm kind of scared of the internet.
I'm scared of the people on the internet. They're mean.
I also loved the passages that capture the magic of going to a convention. My first convention was in 2017, actually, Denver Comic Con, so I'm still a total and complete noob. But this quote is really spot on. People travel from all over to come celebrate their favorite thing together in one place with other people who love that thing. Conventions are entirely based on mutual love of stories. I feel that love in the costumes of the people walking past, in the excited chatter of friends talking about what they want to go see first, in the eyes of little kids gripping their parents' hand, just hoping for a glimpse of their fave. That's from page 321. So there's something really special about a convention, because they have such potential for community and inclusion and celebration, and you kind of go there and you can tell that people aren't afraid to show how much they love the thing that they love.
Yeah, and it's one of the things I really like about going to concerts, even if I don't know the band that well or whatever, because you can, like, it is, I don't even know what the word is, crazy isn't even it, it's thousands of people singing along to their favorite songs, and, like, just, like, based on, like, a few people on stage. Yeah, it's a feeling. I don't know what it is, but to me, when I see that, it's like, wow, this is, like, amazing that so many people could love the same thing so much.
And then you're in community with other people right, there. You're not right. alone anymore listening to the CD.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, not CDs anymore.
I still have CDs. I also really liked when Claire mentioned that cons are a place where people don't have to be ashamed of their fandoms, because I do think that this book did a really good job when we see her at home in Pine Bluff being not bullied, but a little bit ostracized for being a part of a fandom. And I do think that's something that happens a lot if it's not something that is, like, really popular.
Mm-hmm. Or mainstream.
Yeah, exactly. Or even if it is mainstream, sometimes if you like it more than, like, an average person, then you're kind of seen as, like, oh, that's just, it's too far.
Yeah, it's almost like a little bit of tone policing isn't the right word, but you're only allowed to be so excited.
Right.
There's, like, a certain threshold where if you cross it, then you're too much. Right. You're too into it. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, people get put off by that, I guess.
Yeah, but I don't know why, because I'm sure every person has that thing that makes them really excited that other people might not necessarily understand or be a fan of.
And it ties into the whole concept of a guilty pleasure.
Right, which I hate that. I really hate that.
Yeah, and I totally think I didn't show my love for all the different fandoms that I had, especially right. like particularly in high school or college. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And now I'm way more open about the stuff that I love. I mean, like 27 and podcasting about YA books.
Yeah, exactly. It is one of those things. Like, I don't like the term guilty pleasure. People often use it for like romance books. I read romance books or like my favorite band. Like, I am 28 years old and people still to this day make fun of me for my favorite band. I'm like, what the fuck is like, wrong with you?
Where
people?
Do you get off?
Yeah, just because I don't want to listen to Led Zeppelin or Queen or whatever, like, just because I don't like that doesn't mean that you get to be shitty to me because I like something you don't like, you right. know?
No one, when I was growing up, I didn't let anyone know how much I loved Fall Out Boy.
Yeah, I let a lot of people know how much I love My Chemical Romance.
I think that's good, though. I think this is kind of the similar dynamic, like, you were more, like, Claire is more, was more, like, just out there and right. open about her fandom, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of more like Tess, and I wasn't.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
I just didn't share it. I mean, I probably consciously hid it. Looking back, I totally did.
I think it was easier for me because I did find a friend who also was obsessed with MCR, so it made it easier. Like, we went to every, I think I've only been to one MCR concert without her. But I just found one other person. And sometimes I think maybe that's all you need to feel comfortable in your fandom is for one person to, like, say, I see you. I understand how you feel about this thing. And we can like it together.
Which is basically this podcast and yeah. this friendship.
Yeah, exactly. Because I have no one else to talk about YA books with. Like, nope. The few people I know who read them, they don't want to talk about them. And they seem to not want people to know they read them.
You know, like, I'm just kind of done hiding. Yeah. Like, I'm over it.
Yeah, I don't care. It's like cool and fine if it's Harry Potter, but anything past that, people are like, you're an adult. Like, why do you love this thing?
But then you look at like the Bookstagram community.
Yeah.
Online. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wait a second. When you find those communities online, those fandoms online, it opens up a whole other slew of possibilities for you to actually be like open about what you love.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's a great thing because I don't think you should feel bad or guilty for liking what you like.
When Forrest is sneaking around the Demon Heart viewing marathon towards the end of the book, he mm-hmm. has this pretty accurate reflection about how fandom works. And he says, maybe it would have impressed me before, even made me happy to see them so determined. But now I just see how quickly it goes wrong, how quickly love can become zeal, passion can become fanaticism. And I was tracking until then, yes. Okay, I'm with you. But then it was just like a little bit of a letdown moment because he finishes this passage saying, quote, how quickly I can go from having a promising career with opportunities in front of me to the gutter of Hollywood, end quote. I'm like, okay, so it's about you again.
Everything that happens in this book, it's all about like for, well, it's hard because Claire does the same thing a little bit, but and it makes sense. She's young. Like your whole world is whatever's going on with you. But I'm like, Forrest, you're an adult. Like, get it together, man.
But he's know? Still very much in this amateur point in his career,
which I'm sure makes it a little difficult for him. I really hate that guy. I don't remember what his name is in the book. The director he wants to work with.
Oh yeah,
like Reynolds.
John Reynolds,
because he does this whole thing saying like, well, if you are gay, like, we don't want anyone to know that because, like, tough guys can't be gay. Like, we can't cast gay people as tough characters as if
their sexuality had any bearing on their ability to act.
Yeah. Newsflash, they're actors. Like, their whole job is pretending to be someone they are not. And if they can't do that, they're bad actors.
So, but I thought what Forrest said about how love can become zeal and passion can become fanaticism is actually really accurate because people, from a place of love, that can turn into the things people say, particularly online,
right.
can become so mean.
Right.
But it's more because there's a lack of open-mindedness or a lack of empathy or a lack of understanding the other side.
Right. I think sometimes people love something so much, they don't want to give up any piece of what they think that thing is supposed to be, which can be hard. And we see that in like the Harry Potter community where people think like Hermione can't be black, you know, like we can't ship Draco and Harry. Like,
I'm rolling my eyes so hard right now. You can't see.
Which is just, I don't know. It just doesn't make any sense. And it's frustrating.
Yeah, it's funny how some of these fandoms can be so conservative and entrenched in their views.
Right, which is really surprising because a lot of the shows and books that have fandoms, they're not really conservative shows or books, and they actually go a lot in the opposite direction. On page 118, when there's a Demon Heart fan, Riley, and she is talking to Forrest about how the show saved her life, that was a really great moment in the book, and I was like crying, weeping.
Me
because
too.
You know, I think every fandom has these fans where that thing that you're a fan of can get you through some really difficult times, and I really liked how the book showed that something that a lot of people would probably say is silly, like a TV show.
Right, they write it off as right. just entertainment.
Which we see even with the writer of this show, which we'll talk about later. Like, he thinks
that
it's just entertainment, like, it doesn't matter. Those things can be really important to people, and they especially can be really important to young people, because young people, I think, often travel through the world not feeling seen by adults or their peers, even. And sometimes a TV show or a book or a movie can make them feel like, oh, there's something there for me and that things will get better.
Absolutely. And that sentiment gets to the heart of Claire's speech at the end, which I cried. We're talking cried, had to try not to get tears on the library book pages, cried. From page 348 to page 361, it was almost like 20 pages of weeping. And it was so good. And from the moment when the girl in the audience asked Claire the question, I started writing this fiction, this fanfic, and people started making fun of me. And then Claire just goes off and like shares some deep truths about no one should ever make you feel ashamed for what you love. That's awful. And about the importance of representation and why we should be striving for that, which is super important. I have some conflicting views that we'll talk about later, but that moment was just incredible too. It was just like the moment with Riley, but magnified.
Right, exactly. Especially for Claire, because she's like moved to this new town kind of. Obviously she's been in Pine Bluff for a while, but just she doesn't have any friends. So I think she really has a really good sense of what it means and the importance of being part of a fandom when you don't have anything in your like real life communities. That would be hard.
The whole journey through the Demon Heart, like, inner circle experience and going to the cons and meeting Tess and being called out and all that stuff is essentially Claire's journey to coming to terms with her sexuality.
Right.
And she's not going to say definitively, but she does come out in that speech. And it's like the first time that she comes out publicly. But the people in that convention center aren't necessarily going to know that.
Right.
They witnessed that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I just thought that was really beautiful.
Yeah, I really liked it. I really want Britta London to like write more books now because this was like so well done.
Please write just more books.
Like I was laughing, I was crying, like it was just like all the feelings, and it made me really happy to have this book. I liked it a lot.
Me too. Thank you for writing it.
Yeah.
If you're listening.
Yeah, thanks so much. Also a little bit meta because there was like someone dressed as Jughead at one of the conventions.
And I totally
also, I didn't realize until later that she had written like writes for Riverdale, and I was just like, oh, Jughead's my favorite. And now I'm like, I want to be Jughead for Halloween. That seems like great. I'm going to knit myself a hat.
We aren't going to talk about magic in our Wands Out segment because Ship It isn't, like I said before, strictly speaking, a fantasy novel. So instead, we're going to do a little get to know you segment and talk about our first fandoms.
My first fandom was obviously Harry Potter because I started reading it when I was 8 years old. I think the first midnight book release I went to was Goblet of Fire, and I went to all of them after that. And it was amazing. Gryffindors for life. Sorry, Kelly.
Harry Potter was definitely my first fandom. I think I started reading it when I was 7, so at the same time. And I remember we didn't go to the midnight showings because I was on swim team. So we'd have to get up at like 5 a.m. on Saturday morning. So the book would come out on Friday, but then we'd stop by the grocery store on Saturday morning on the way to the swim meet, and I would read it in a day. I would sit there and in between my events be in my sleeping bag, all wet and smelling like chlorine, and read Harry Potter all day. And then the last book I got was released when I was studying abroad in Spain. So I have the European edition of the last one.
Is it in Spanish?
It is not. I found an international bookstore. It was a saga. But yeah, I just remember bawling and weeping and being like, this is the last time I'm going to read a Harry Potter book for the first time.
Yeah. I also was like in tears going to Harry Potter World for the first time. Like, that was a birthday present from my significant other, and I was so excited. I didn't even know we could go to the rest of Universal. I thought it was just for Harry Potter World until we got there. But when I like got there and saw Hogwarts and Hogsmeade, I was like in tears. It was super magical.
So beautiful.
It was the best.
Now we're going to talk about conflict villains and good versus evil in a segment called Get Me Kylo Ren. So there's this moment in the bathroom when Forrest overhears someone being really condescending about the young women and girls attending the convention, when the reader thinks Forrest is actually getting it, as in understanding his fan base, appreciating and supporting them. But right when Forrest is going to verbally take down this asshole, he realizes that the D-bag is John Reynolds, and it's the man behind the Red Zone project that Forrest desperately wants to be in. So Forrest puts his own interests first and acts like he's on board with the misogyny, and by doing so, he's not being neutral. Forrest's inaction contributes to the attitudes that continue to discredit and devalue young women's opinions about the world, a letdown to say the least. But I think this book did an impressive job distilling these sorts of structural inequities, like problems with the entertainment industry, into little one-off scenes. Like, I thought this scene really captured the disdain, I think, for women in fandom particularly.
Yeah, because you do see it a lot. I think we're gonna end up talking about Harry Potter a lot in this episode, I think, because I think
just so close to our hearts.
I do think it's one of the fandoms. Harry Potter is one of the few fandoms where there seems to be more women than men. Or maybe it's more equal, because I don't think we see the disdain for women as much in Harry Potter fandoms, but I do think we see it a lot in anything relating to video games or comic books. I think it's really bad in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this book, even though it's a TV show, I think this book does a good job of showing that, how women aren't taken seriously in the fan, like they're not taken as seriously as the men in the fandoms.
Well, and they're what they want is seen as less than.
Right. There's even a part where Claire talks about how like women writers, like teenage girls and women, are seen as like crazy for thinking specific things, and they're not considered serious writers. Like fanfic is for teenagers and women because they're unhinged. I think that's the word she uses. And like serious writing is all done by the men. And that was a good depiction of like how Jamie and I guess John Reynolds like seem to go through their world. Like no one's as serious as them. Yeah.
Right. And they want to make like this high, not literature, but like, I don't know.
Which is interesting because you're taking a video game and making it into a movie. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it's interesting that you think that is more impressive than a girl who has written thousands of pages worth of fan fiction based off two characters. Like, she's probably written more than you have for this, your spinoff, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're taking a video game and turning it into a movie, you're basically writing fan fiction.
It's an adaptation. Yeah, it's an expansion of the original cultural artifact into something else. Another central moment of conflict was this kind of shared outing where Tess outs Claire and Claire outs Tess.
I was so frustrated. Like, angry.
Which means it's good writing.
It was. Because I was angry at both of them.
Yes.
Although I was frustrated with Claire throughout the story, like, a lot.
Because it's essentially just two sides of the same coin. Tess is saying to Claire, just love who you want to love. And right. Claire is saying to Tess, just love what you want to love.
Right. And it's true. Like, when we were talking about guilty pleasures, like, you shouldn't feel bad for what you love, and loving who you love is also not something you should feel guilty about.
When I was starting to read this, I was a little bit more on Claire's side.
Right.
Until Tess was explaining, like, no, you don't understand. I'm the only Black girl. All right. So she's already different. And she's the only queer person in her friend circle. So right. There you go. I was definitely more like understanding how they're like equal. At first I was like, these two experiences aren't the same.
Right.
And they're not the same, but they can have as much gravity.
Right.
Depending on which situation you're in and what your intersecting identity is like.
And I think Tess talks about, like we talked about in the last episode for Children of Blood and Bone, like she has to be twice as good. So she's coming from a very different place than Claire, and like these are a lot of things Claire hasn't thought of, which is kind of interesting because she doesn't even think about how like Demon Heart, like they kill off all the women, and she seems to identify as a woman. So it's interesting that she sees this one aspect about herself that she wants to see in the show, but none of her other aspects or none of anyone else's, which I thought was really interesting and surprising.
It was essentially a lesson in intersectionality.
Yes. And a necessary one. I was really proud of Tess. I mean, I was still mad at her. She shouldn't have outed her to her mom.
Outed Claire to her
mom. Yeah. And honestly, Claire's mom was like the sweetest, most like gentle, kind.
I want to be friends
cool
with her mom.
I know. I like how her mom's like.
I like how she just like paints her naked self portraits of herself.
But it's also like, if you're going to have sex, use protection. Don't do any crazy drugs. And I laughed out loud at those parts. And it was also funny because I thought, maybe we all hate our moms, like maybe that's just normal. Like Claire has a cool mom and she's like, oh mom, and I'm like that seems like a good mom.
And I'm curious to hear what you think, Jesse, but I would say that Jamie is the primary villain in the book, and he has zero concept of what privilege is and zero interest in changing anything and zero interest in caring about the fans of the show or furthering any sort of progress in the industry. So this is the quote that like really gets to the core of this character, I think. He says, "Thank you, Claire. There's so much I didn't know about myself from that I learned from people like you," he snarks. "I didn't know that I was given everything in life just because I was a straight white man. And here I thought I worked my ass off for it." And then Jamie ends his tirade saying, "I didn't know I was upholding the patriarchy. I thought I was telling monster stories for an hour a week."
Jamie,
take a breath.
I know. Like a big breath. Jamie, to me, is the perfect depiction of privileged white man. That's what he is. He is like why there's systemic racism. He is why like women don't always get a say in their government and their bodies. Like, he knows the argument points, but doesn't understand them at all.
He knows the vocab.
Yeah. Yeah. He knows the vocab with no understanding. Like, he can regurgitate it, but he doesn't know what it means.
It's like missing the point. And this sentence about, "I didn't know I was giving everything just because I was a straight white man. I thought I worked my ass off for it." That's just a fundamental misunderstanding of how privilege works. I'm not saying your life isn't hard
right.
as a straight white man. I'm just saying it's not hard because you're a straight white man.
Right. It's hard because I think it's really difficult for people to come face to face with their privilege, because it's not fun to think about like, oh, like I might have an easier time traveling through the world because of how I look or because of what I am. But I don't think that means, like, I just don't know how you can ignore all these things, like the wage gap and like your show, they had to ask you to put people of color in it and you were like, no, thank you, I don't want that. Jamie as a character is so frustrating to me. And because the author actually works in television, makes me wonder how often she has actually interacted with these kind of assholes.
Probably a fair amount.
Yeah. Because from what I've heard from like other female writers, like the writer's room can be difficult for women. Now, her show's on the CW and they seem to often have women writers, which is like great.
And
you know?
More groundbreaking shows that
yeah.
are doing more for inclusion, like
right.
Oh My God, Jane the Virgin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I bet like starting out, I wonder if she meets like a lot of these people or sees them even still in the industry today.
You know, Jesse,
What?
One does not simply read fantasy adjacent novels without talking about representations of race, class, and gender. More than we already have been talking about them.
It's so tied up in this story. This is another story where it's like
everywhere.
All of those things.
Is it time for my sermon?
It's time for Kelly's sermon. Okay. She gets a sermon this time. I had to do a lot of talking last time. I'll let Kelly do a lot of talking this time.
So I want to pick back up the thread of Claire's fight for representation on screen, aka visible representation. And I'm conflicted about Claire's approach for a number of reasons. So what I mean by Claire's approach is wanting to make her ship canon IRL by having Smokey and Hart's characters be openly gay on the show. So that's her mission. First, I do think more inclusive stories are absolutely a step in the right direction, and we need them so badly. And the same with inclusive casting. So I'm thinking the sorts of initiatives like the Gina Davis Institute for Gender and Media, which is the slogan, if she can see it, she can be it. Visible representation is so important, especially for young people. So I want to start there. But these sorts of diversity initiatives, the visible ones, can't be the end of the efforts for an inclusive art or entertainment or cultural products. So there's also have to be more diverse contributors to the technical and creative aspects, all the technical team, the writers behind it, but also the money behind the projects, because that is definitely going to affect the sorts of decisions that are made in production and post-production. But at the end of the day, we're talking about a massive industry that is a major player in our capitalist system, which exploits the most marginalized while the most privileged benefit the most, right? So when I'm thinking of an example is the white wealthy studio execs making a ton of money off the success of Black Panther, which did have a lot more diversity behind the camera as well. But still, this movie achieved box office success largely because Black people came out and spent their money on it. So what I'm trying to say is that there will inevitably be rich white people getting even richer thanks to people with staggeringly less privilege. Does the entertainment industry, or capitalism for that matter, is it like gonna go anywhere anytime soon? Probably not. Not really showing signs of that. But I think what's important is while these current systems are in place, of fucking course, we need more representation and more diverse, more inclusive art, casting decisions, behind the scenes, writers, directors, producers, musicians, camera people, editors, everything. But we can't forget that the industry sees us, no matter how we identify, as consumers, as people who buy things. So the corporate takeover of Pride is a perfect example. Companies aren't setting out to protect your marginalized identity because companies set out to make money. And this tension is always going to be present while capitalism exists. But I want to be clear, I didn't go down this rabbit hole to shame anyone for buying products related to the things they love. I'd be a complete hypocrite. I've spent the hundreds of dollars to go to Harry Potter World. I like fuck up and buy too much stuff from Amazon because I love me some two-day shipping. But I do think that we should at least remain conscious of the systems within which we're all operating. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I think the hard part now, as it stands, is that we live in a capitalist society. And I think that a lot of the problem comes from not having people of diverse backgrounds at the top tiers of businesses. So I think sometimes the decisions they make can be seen as like intentional to make money, as opposed to wanting to help a cause. So when I think about right now what's going on, like Colin Kaepernick being the face of Nike right now in his Just Do It campaign, I'm like really glad for that, because I think like what he was doing wasn't wrong. He took a stand for something that he believed in criminal justice reform. Like, police shouldn't be shooting people because they're there.
But because they're Black.
Because they're Black. Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, now Nike is making a shit ton of money because they chose someone who was doing something out of protest.
How much money is Nike donating to Black Lives Matter initiatives is my question.
Exactly.
Are they going to stop using slave labor overseas?
Exactly. And that's the real problem, is that these companies want to make money, and that's the most important thing to them. And if using someone like Colin Kaepernick makes them that money, they're going to do that. Like, they want to appeal to whoever's going to make them the most money. And that's it.
So buy Black.
Yeah. So I think that a lot of it needs to start coming from the top down. Like, there need to be more gay people, more women, more transgender people, more people of color. Like, those people need to be in top positions. And then I think
that the revolution can begin.
Yeah. And like, companies will make decisions, maybe more, they'll have more initiatives to help people as opposed to just trying to make money. Black Panther was amazing though. So like, I'm real happy, and
that's what I mean, is I'm so conflicted about it.
I know.
And I mean, it's like, maybe it's my Gemini brain just not stopping ever. But I'm like seeing these multiple aspects like all the time. And so I just wanted to put it out there on the table.
But you have to think about it, because like, Black Panther does this amazing thing where it, one, shows Black girls that they can be strong and powerful warriors. Like, Black people can be superheroes. Like, it does all of those things. Black people can work in technology and be better at it than Tony Stark. Like, it does all of those things. But at the same time, like, it's there to make money, and Marvel Studios is run by white men.
Someone's work to check out on this is a woman who's working at the University of Hawaii. I believe her name is Ida Yoshinaga. I met her at a conference this summer, and she works on this like diversity initiatives within Disney. And what does that mean, given that it's corporate and it's just trying to make money off of people? So I can try and find her work and link to it in the show notes. But it's like it's an ongoing conversation, and we're not going to resolve it right here.
No, I don't know what the right thing to do is, because of capitalism, like, the bottom line is always going to be money. It's not going to be, let's have more people of color because we care about making that happen. It's, let's do that because it's what people want to see. And if we don't, we get accused of racism and people won't watch our show.
Exactly. They're doing it because now it's a necessary thing in order to keep making money. So coming back to fan fiction after my whole rant and rave about capitalism is, I think Tess is really onto something when she talks about the freedom of fan fiction to be anything the writer and other fans want or need. So she says the following, quote, "Maybe it's because I grew up only seeing white people on my television, and it's not like a showrunner can decide that one day a character's not white anymore. So I got used to the world being unfair, okay? I stopped caring what the showrunner thinks because a character can be anything in fic. They can be black or queer or fat or whatever the fuck I want, and I don't need anyone's permission." It's on page 237. And this made me think that fan fiction is at this really interesting intersection, because it simultaneously owes its existence to industry conglomerates and operates outside of those systems, often by subverting them in the context of the fics themselves, like how Claire ships Smokey and Hart together, or by depicting Hermione as black, for example, before the casting of The Cursed Child came out. And I don't know, I just had that thought. Also, go check out that Hermione fan art. It's beautiful.
So beautiful, and I love it so much. But I think you make a really good point, because fan fiction, I think, is probably where people get to see themselves in books that they don't get to normally. So for Claire and Tess, that means having Smokey and Hart be together, or like Harry and Draco, or making Hermione black, or gender bending your characters. Like, that's really important to people because they are not, obviously not getting what they need from what they already have. And I think as time goes on, we see that getting better, especially in YA, but I don't think it'll stop people from writing their fan fiction to get exactly what they need out of characters. And it's also great for their readers, because then they get to see themselves and what they need in fanfic as well. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so we're going to talk about race a little bit. Claire on page 35 says, "Basically, Smokey's discriminating against all demons without thinking of them as individuals. And yeah, most of them are evil, but he already knows Hart isn't like the others. He just doesn't trust Hart yet." This really stuck out to me because I'm from the South, so there are black people there, unlike in Boulder where we live. But there are also a lot of racist white people, and we like to call it like quiet racism. So this is how racism works in communities where there are only a few people of color. White people usually think all POCs are evil except for the ones they know. And this really reminded me of that. But it was funny that Claire said, yeah, most of them are evil. And that was really like cringy to me.
She doesn't take the extra step to be like, oh, Hart's okay, so maybe other demons are okay too.
Yeah. And it's especially bad because Hart / Rico is both the bad guy of the show and the only POC in the show. Do you think Jamie made him the bad guy because he didn't want to diversify his cast in the first place?
I don't know. That's a good question. Jamie couldn't give two shits about diversity, clearly.
I mean, he said it.
Yeah.
Right.
We know he doesn't care. I think he just cast the Rico, the actor, as Hart because Rico is from a different sci-fi series. He got famous from a different sci-fi series with some like Battlestar Galactica or Star Trek vibes. And I think it was a purely like a marketing decision because they wanted a bigger name.
Yeah.
Because Forrest is an unknown entity until that he gets cast in that show.
I didn't like it.
You didn't like Claire's comment?
No. It was like frustrating to
me. The fact that you pointed out this quote makes me this like, I know an individual one, but yet can't interrogate my views of the group.
Right.
Makes me think of tactics that some white people use when they get called out for doing or saying or posting something racist. So if they get called out for their racism, here's things like, I have a black friend who's fine with me saying the N-word, so it's fine if I say it. I've gotten permission from this one person. Or the problematic thing I said about black people isn't racist because I have some sort of personal connection with a black person in my life. Or like, I'm nice to my black barista, so I get out of jail free.
Yeah.
Which you might because you're white.
Yeah,
so.
You probably will.
Or not free because you can pay for it. Yeah. That was an apropos cliche phrase to use. Obviously, that's wrong. Like, here's the thing. The individuals you know that you're calling on to excuse your racist comment are part of a larger community that are racialized and negatively affected by the system of white supremacy, which inherently benefits white people. So maybe, like, interrogate why being called racist seems like the end of the world, or it can to certain white people.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, you have to deal with your shame and your guilt and your complicity, but in order to move forward, you have to deal with it and then do better next time.
Right.
And for anyone who's interested, Robin DiAngelo's work on white fragility is really good. And the white fragility episode on the podcast, Call Your Girlfriend, is also really good.
Yeah. I think this part really reminded me of my mom. My mom's white. And she thinks she can't be racist because she has black children, like half black children. And she, you know, she was married to my dad who was black. Like, even that close of a relationship to a person of color does not mean that you cannot be racist. It does not mean that you get a pass at all. I think that sometimes people think, especially if you're super close to a person of color or a gay person or whatever, that you get a pass. And you could literally be their mom. You don't get a pass. There's a part, it's a very small part, that made me very happy. So when Tess is staying the night with Claire and her mom, she is wearing a headscarf when she goes to sleep. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I never see this in books, unless they're written by black people, where a person of color puts their hair in a headscarf. And this was a sign to me that Britta London really did her homework. And it made me so happy because I do that every day. And you just don't see it in books. It was just like the smallest little thing. And I was like, oh my gosh, yay for positive, good, accurate representation of curly-haired people.
Tess also makes some really good points about race when she talks to Claire. And of course she would, right? Because not only do people of color deal with the consequences of structural racism on a daily basis, they also shoulder the vast majority of the educational and consciousness-raising and advocacy burden on these same issues. So the good thing is that Claire actually learns after Tess calls her out and is like, yeah, but you don't complain that they kill off all the black characters on Demon Heart. So at the end of the novel, when Claire confronts Jamie, she actually, and gives her a speech at San Diego Comic-Con both times, she includes other identity positions in her advocacy besides just sexuality, which is at the beginning of the novel and throughout most of the novel her main focus. I think this is a good example of how you can be not comfortable with the call out at first, but then you like own your shit and do better next time.
Yeah, and we see that with Forrest as well, which was very like an aw moment for me when he like decides to kiss Rico at the end to like make Claire's fanfic real for her and like the people who really wanted that. And I was like, you get it, you got it, this is how this should work.
He grew a lot in that regard.
So much.
His character development was impressive
and it felt believable. That is some good writing for me not to be like, oh, you're just doing this so like you can like tie up all your loose ends. It felt real.
Oh, it totally did.
And like, oh, I just loved it so much. And I think this also goes back a little bit to what I was saying earlier. Like, I was surprised. Like, I was so glad that Tess called Claire out, but at the same time, I was like, Claire, how'd you not realize, like, all the women get killed? Like, what? Like, it was surprising to me to get that from Claire.
I mean, it kind of, like, just kind of shows the tendency towards tunnel vision sometimes.
Yeah, I guess we don't always see, like...
Also, she's 16.
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah, she's a kid. Yeah, I get it.
Like, I was not doing this sort of thing at 16. I wasn't doing, like, I was so chicken shit at 16.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. All right, Claire, you get a pass. I mean, a small one. Like, you came around, so you're
good. So it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. I was really glad to see people of color in the fandom because I feel like a lot of us get pushed to the fringes of fandoms just in general. I don't know why. But I like that the book didn't make it seem like it was unusual to have POCs in the fandom. I think maybe because so much of fantasy is written by white people, there's a lot of white characters. So people don't necessarily assume that people of color are gonna relate to that, as if it's not like what we're forced to do on a day-to-day basis because like that's all of our media. But I really liked that the author included that.
Do you get a sense that this erasure and lack of representation is shifting at all?
I don't know. I think I meet more people of color who would consider themselves part of fandoms. But because I don't always go to those kinds of things, like conventions or whatever, I don't really see us as much. But I do think we get included more in fantasy, in TV shows, and not just as like a token character. So like, while I hate that Missandei and Grey Worm are slaves initially in the story in Game of Thrones, on the TV show, they do have them being strong characters and they're freed by a white lady, which is frustrating, but they're not like on the fringes of the story always. And that, I think, helps bring more people of color into fandoms.
And I should be completely honest because I did not even think of the fact that some of the only POC on Game of Thrones are slaves.
Almost all of them.
I, like, no, like, literally right now. You're telling me right now, and I'm like, oh, shit. That's my, like, white privilege. I didn't even think about it. I didn't even interrogate it at all.
Yeah. And it's also weird, too, for Game of Thrones, because it's like, there are a shit ton of white people. Like, most of the story's white people. Why are there black people slaves? Like, where did those people come from, and why did you make them the slaves?
Yeah, because it's set in a fantastic place. You didn't have to go along with that.
Yeah. So those kind of things are frustrating, but I think things like, I'll just talk about TV shows, like having Bonnie from Vampire Diaries be a witch and she's powerful, or in the originals having, what's his name? Oh, Marcel. He's like in charge of the vampires when they get to New Orleans. All those things, they're like bringing black characters in or people of color, or even Veronica on Riverdale is Latina. Those kinds of things, I think, are important to bringing more people from other communities into fandoms. I don't know if this particularly goes along with talking about gender, but I think I related to it having been a teenage girl once, talking about self-worth. And there's this like really heartbreaking moment on page 168 where Claire, in her exposition, I think that Forrest asked her if a boy had ever kissed her before. And Claire's in her exposition says, yes, a boy liked me. Yes, a boy kissed me. And yes, I could be loved. And this was so awful to me to think that young people use the value other people place on them to decide whether they're worthy to be who they are. And they're only worthy if someone else is willing to look at them and say they like them and want something from them. And I think our movies and TV shows often perpetuate this because so many of our storylines have to do with finding someone to love, finding someone who will love you as who you are, or changing yourself so that someone will. And so this, I like was bawling reading this. Like, this was just like gut wrenching. Like, it was so many feels.
Absolutely. And so that makes me sad. And then also then after I am sad about it, I get mad because I realize that when I read things or watch things, then I'm looking for people to get together.
Yeah.
Right. I'm like, I don't know, not even like heteronormativity, of course, but even just like the ace spectrum is real. Asexual people are real. And also, like, why does romantic love have to be the center of all of my narratives?
Right.
But then I notice myself looking for it. Mm-hmm. And so then I get mad at myself. And it's probably because of how much I've been trained to want that in a narrative.
Yeah. And I think it's hard too, because like I find myself struggling sometimes when I do read romance, like I'll go through like these long hauls of just reading like all romance books where I'm like, why though? Like, why is that so important? Like, why can't you just live your life without those things? Like, you don't need someone else to complete you. I'm putting it complete you in quotes because that's what people say. Like, you should be a person all by yourself. And when you're ready, or if you want to, find someone to be with, you know? Yeah, that was like a hard part for me to read.
And very real. Real talk.
Yeah, because I do think, especially as teenagers, obviously I don't speak on behalf of teenage boys, but as teenage girls, I think so much of our self-worth is wrapped up in how we look.
Just being an object of desire for someone. And a lot of times it's like romantic or sexual desire.
Yeah. Sometimes I think because we see these things like movies and TV shows while we're young, it also pushes us to want these things at a very young age.
Right.
Which is really unfortunate. Like even our Disney movies, you know?
Mm-hmm. When we see all this strong character development of especially like young women characters finding their own self-worth in YA. And I don't know about you, but like that didn't happen for me when I was the same age as these characters.
No.
That didn't happen for me at 16. Mm-mm. It like barely happened at 25.
Yeah, I'm still struggling with that now.
And yeah, I think that there's this tendency to think that like, oh, that's only a struggle that happens for adolescents or for teenagers. And I don't think that's true.
Maybe that's why we see so many older people, I guess our age people, reading YA, because like the things that teenagers struggle with, we still struggle with. It's just not the biggest part of our lives anymore because like there's so much other stuff going on and the stakes aren't as high. But we still feel those feelings and remember what it was like to feel that way.
Right. And I guess it's also never as clear cut in real life as it is in a narrative.
No.
That sort of development, like internal struggles.
Yeah. Which is probably why like YA works so well, because it's written from like an older perspective looking back on what it felt like to feel these things. I wonder if like YA authors work through these things in themselves a little better because they've like written it out and worked through it through their characters.
Probably.
Yeah. They're probably so much better adjusted.
It certainly helps me work it out reading it.
Yeah. But yeah, that one really like got me.
So related to self-worth, there's a lot of imposter syndrome from everyone except Rico.
Rico is like goals, man. Like exactly what everyone probably wishes they were. Like you just know yourself and know your worth without needing anyone else to tell you you're worth it.
I wonder if we saw anything from, if we had any POV chapters from him.
I wish
we did. If we'd see the difference, if we'd see a different side of him.
That's true.
Because there are certainly people who project that air of confidence and are just all sorts of messed up on the inside.
That's true. I bet we would. Because I'm sure people don't look at, like, even us who are self-aware that we work through these things and think, like, they don't have it all together yet.
Yeah, lots of us don't present confused. Some of us do, and that's totally fine. But others of us don't.
Yeah. And it's a hard thing, like walking through the world thinking everyone else has their shit together, knowing you don't. And it's good to like remind yourself, like, no one has their shit together. Like, no one.
Mm-hmm. For me, some of the most heartbreaking scenes of imposter syndrome were from Forrest's point of view, where he's talking about how he just has such a hard time seeing himself and being with himself, and especially these like really restrictive dieting that he has to do. He's like, well, I guess I'll just go home and eat chicken and broccoli, or I haven't had Dairy Queen in years.
Yeah.
Which he like, it brings him joy because of the ruthless fat phobia of the entertainment industry.
Which is also really interesting because I also don't think we get that very often in our media where men struggle with that. It's almost always like women are dieting. Women need to keep up their physique for these things. Like, even though we know that like famous people have to work out to look the way they look, we don't really think of the men as needing to be held to those high standards as well.
Yeah.
I also thought it was really interesting with Forrest, because when he's reading Claire's fanfic about Smokey and Hart, he starts to question his own sexuality instead of the character's sexuality. And I thought, like, that's really interesting. Like, he is confused about his own sexuality and doesn't even realize it until he reads himself so much into his own character that he thinks, well, what could I be, you know?
Because that's one of the original things that Claire explains to him. And she's like, no, I'm shipping your characters. Like, get over yourself. I'm not talking about you, as in Forrest. It's not about you.
Right. But he's so tied up in that character that he's like, whatever's going on with that character is going on with me almost.
I think it's that the scenes with Forrest and him questioning his own sexuality are a good example of how we just take things for granted. Right. And sometimes if it doesn't occur to you to question it, then you just go along with the script.
Especially like with like heteronormativity, like I think it's maybe unusual for people to think, well, could I be gay? Like, could I be queer? Because you don't think about it because it's not what we're quote unquote supposed to be. Like, that's not what society tells us. Like, society tells us that, like, well, you're straight unless otherwise, you know? So I wonder if some people don't think about the possibility. Like,
and then if you're not straight, you need a label and you need it right now. Right. And it needs to not change.
Right. And that's kind of what Claire's going through, like, because Tess is like so sure of herself.
Yeah, she's a homoromantic pansexual.
Yeah. And Claire's like, well, I never thought about it. I don't know what I am. And she doesn't have a label at the end. And that's okay too. Like, have your whole life to figure it out.
I thought that conversation between, or that what Claire's struggling with was really, looking for a word, poignant.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the vocabulary can be pretty inaccessible and be really intimidating because you're worried about using the wrong word or being stuck with it. But, you know, sometimes you change.
Yeah. And I think that's just true in our culture today too, because the internet exists and you should be able to like look up all these things. Like, I think even sometimes when you're not part of a group, like myself, like I'm not part of every group. So sometimes I'm like, well, let me think this through. I don't want to say the right thing to offend someone, which is true. You don't want to offend someone, but you should also feel comfortable in saying like, I'm not sure what I should say here. So let me find some information about this.
Yeah, but you have to say it. And then if you get called out, and that's fine. Just own it and then do better next
apologize,
time.
Apologize, say you didn't know. Yeah, and do better next time.
I was more talking about like Claire's struggle to find a word. How she really is like, well, what if I don't know my exact label right now? Like, what if I don't know my feelings? Does that mean I have to be then, like, do I have to be then friends with the one gay person at Pine Bluff if I come out?
Yeah. But I do think some of that comes from like not even knowing. Like, she didn't even know what all that stuff meant that Tess said.
Right, exactly.
So she doesn't even know what her options are, which is like, I'm sure people feel that way, obviously. And it's also like, wow, like you don't think about like not knowing what the possibilities are, you know, to be who you feel you are. If you can't put it into words, it's almost like it doesn't exist, you know?
Or you can certainly feel that way.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it can feel like, where do I fit in? I don't have the words for it, so I don't fit in anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sad. Do you think it was wrong for Claire to write the fanfic about Forrest? Like, I forget what they called it.
Something about cream. Very double entendre.
I mean, I forget what they called the fic that is when you write about a real person.
Oh, you didn't mean the title of the fic.
Although I didn't remember that either.
I remember cream was in the title.
Yeah. But do you think it was wrong of her to do that?
Wrong to write it? Maybe not. But wrong to post it? Definitely. Because she abused trust and used confident information, one. And she put it out there. It's different if you, like, write a letter and keep it in your drawer.
Right.
Plus, the effect is compounded given Claire's high follower count online. She has a platform. But at the same time, she's 16. She fucks up. But she does take the fic down and apologize after to Forrest.
Yeah. I think one of the harder parts when I was reading that story was her, like, I wouldn't call them allegations, but, like, in the story, she wrote that he was, like, an abused child, like, abused by his parent. And that, I think, like, I don't think it was right for her to publish in the first place, but putting that in with people knowing that she knows him, that was like, oh, because like if you were abused by your parent and he hadn't told anyone, like if that had been true and she didn't even know it, like you don't want people to know that all the time. Like that's your information to put out into the world. And for me, I was like, oh, that's like, that's really bad.
I think your point that people know that she knows the actor. Yeah,
that is, yeah, exactly.
So they wouldn't necessarily be able to determine what is fiction and what, like, where the kernels of truth are in the story and where it isn't. And it just seems negligent.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I thought as well. On a happier note, I just want to talk about Rico for a second and say that he was one of my favorite characters. He's a person of color who identifies as male, who understands the needs for all type of representation and not just based on color. He learns to knit, breaking down gender and racial stereotypes, and he's willing to kiss Forrest, which also breaks down some racial stereotypes. And he's so nice and sweet with his fans, and I just loved him so much.
Me too. You encapsulated it perfectly.
Can you like be my best friend? I'll teach you how to knit some cool stuff. So finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take some liberties and do some shipping of our own, which maybe isn't necessary this time because the whole book is about shipping.
Yay!
Yay, shipping. Oh, we love it.
I think we must speak about the kiss at the end. Normally, I'm like, come on, give me more than a kiss. But the buildup was so drawn out and fraught and intense, and I didn't know if it was going to happen. And then the kiss took on this, like, transcendent importance of a climax, pun totally intended. And it was sexy and tender and vulnerable and political and brave. And, oh my God, I have so many feelings about it.
It was just so great. And I was, like, happy that Rico was willing to go along with it, that Forrest is, like, I'm going to do this. Like, I'm going to make this real for her, even though it doesn't end up, but like that director was like, this would ruin your career. Like, he literally tells him before he goes into that convention hall, like, don't fuck this up.
And Forrest is like, screw all y'all.
Yeah. He's like, I'm going to do this. Like, it's important. And that made me really happy.
The scene being written was really powerful. I don't think you can get that across in a visual medium the same way.
No, because there's so much of Forrest's internal monologue. Man, I can't imagine someone acting so well that we could see all of those feelings and all that thought process like on their face.
I think that's kind of why I like reading about love so much.
Yeah, that's true. Although I'm a sucker for a good romantic comedy. Sorry, not sorry.
But on a story level, serious props to Forrest for learning and growing as a person. I know I mentioned this briefly before, but also props to Britta London for crafting the whole story that led up to that point and for not letting the readers down. It was so rewarding.
Yeah, thanks so much for not being Cursed Child Part 2.
It's high praise.
Some of the fanfic that Claire was writing, like, they didn't ever show an ending to things, but I was just like, wow, this is published by Disney. Like, I was shocked, but I was also like, go Disney, like, good on ya.
I love how the book starts out with her Googling reach around in her library and like the porn coming on.
I'm like, there are just some things you don't look up in a library, especially without headphones on. I mean,
so puritanical, Jesse.
I work in a library, so I'm like, you can't, not allowed to look those things up in a library.
It's very close to home for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think the presence of actual sex, maybe not penetrative sex, right, but definitely sexual acts, mm-hmm, can't be understated, because sexuality isn't just about romantic love, although that's certainly a component. It's also about, shocker, who you want to have sex with.
Right.
And I say this because I think it's way easier for heteronormative culture to embrace LGBTQIA love than it, mm-hmm, is to embrace LGBTQIA sex.
Oh, I think you're 100% correct. Yeah, I think that's true, because I know a person who says that they believe it's fine for gay people to get married and they're okay with like all the things that come along with that, but they don't want to see gay people kissing on TV. They think that's just too far, but they wouldn't say that about a heterosexual couple. And to me, that is a sign you're not okay with it, that you're homophobic. Like, that is the end of the line. Like, if you're okay seeing two straight people kiss on TV but not two gay people, that's homophobia. Sorry, but like, get your shit together. Yeah, I was real happy about it.
Actual sex.
Yeah.
In the book.
Yeah.
I thought this was like so important.
Yeah.
That it's not just about like, oh, they're in love with each other romantically. It's like, no, they want to bang.
Yeah. And sometimes that's just what people want to do. Like, then let them do it.
Let them bang.
Let them bang.
Let them eat cake and let them bang.
I also loved that even though Forrest at first was like not on board with the Smokey and Hart thing, he like totally shipped Tess and Claire. But like that he can like see two people and be like, yeah, they need to be together. It's like, you get shipping. Like, you obviously get it. So like, get on board.
It was so cute.
Get on board the ship.
Let's talk a little bit more explicitly about writing style and narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind style-wise in a segment called Kill Your Darlings.
So I think Britta London does a fantastic job of making the fanfics and the POV sound different. Forrest and Claire sound nothing alike, and then Claire's fanfic sounds like it was written by a teenager.
I'm curious why you say that, because I didn't have the same impression.
Oh, really? Okay, so there's like some like
I thought the fanfics were written by a professional writer.
Okay, so I think they're like higher caliber than like the fanfic I've read in real life, and that's nothing against people's fanfics. I just think like because I'm reading Harry Potter fanfic, they don't always sound like J.K. Rowling, you know, and that's hard. That's hard because it's like not your writing voice, but
also when you want Harry and Draco to bang, yeah. J.K. Rowling's not going to write that.
No, she's not.
Or Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Just saying.
Yeah, that's true. But I think that there was like some phrases, like the way that the exposition was written or like the characters would say things that just sounded like a teenager to me for some reason. And I was like, this sounds different than Britta London writing Claire and Forrest. That felt like Britta London writing Claire. And I don't know, something about it, I was just like even when I wasn't paying attention to the POV, I was like, oh yeah, this is the fanfic. Like, this sounds like Claire talking as her writer voice.
And I think the fanfic chapters were the only one that didn't have a name under the number.
Yeah, they were, because it tricked me once. Like, chapter 19, I think, didn't have a name, but then Forrest was talking and I was like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, did they mess up in the book? But then it was her like real, like the fan fiction she wrote about Forrest, and I was like, oh, okay, I got it.
I agree about the point of view being totally differentiated.
Yeah,
and I think that it helped that the both those characters are struggling with different things, so she was able to, the author was able to develop their individual struggles.
Yeah, and I thought, like, I guess we do get a lot in YA where women are writing men, but I thought she did a good job writing for us. He seemed like a dude, bro. I think we talked about this quote earlier a little bit where Claire said, I think it was Claire, says, because the only way to make sure someone writes exactly the fic you want is to write it yourself. And I really love how this applies to writing, because I see sometimes on like when fans are interacting with authors, they're like, oh, you should write a story about like this, and they're like, no, you should write it, you want that story, you should write it. So I liked how this applied to writing overall, but I also thought it was weird that Claire read her own fan fiction, and I wonder if people do that in real life.
I didn't think that she was doing it for entertainment purposes. I thought that she was reading it because something particularly like heavy had happened to her, because I think that the moments when Claire turns to her own fics and opens up her computer to read is after something particularly, I'm thinking fuerte, but that's not the right word. Yeah, Claire reads her own fics in order to cope with something right. particularly heavy that's happened to her.
I just wonder if like other people who write fanfic or authors in general do that.
Read their own books.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think about like when I sometimes listen or read to Harry Potter when like I'm feeling anxious, you know, because it's familiar to me. But I wonder if authors feel that way about their own work. I don't know.
Let us know. If you write stuff.
Yeah. Do you read your own work? Like, not for editing purpose, but for fun purposes or
therapeutic purposes.
Yeah. Let us know.
So Britta London is a writer on the show Riverdale, which the, you know, listeners might know. And in the author's note, London mentions that Shipit was originally written as a screenplay, and she turned it into a book at some other people's suggestion. And I'm so glad it's a novel, because we get to read Claire's fan fiction, number one. I don't know. I think being able to actually read the fics that she writes, because the fics are so important to her, and that's like, she wants to make her ship canon, and she ships them in her fan fiction, that's such a core part of the work. that I'm really glad that it's in novel format.
I think if it were a TV show or a movie, it would be really difficult not to make that seem like really cheesy, because you'd have to like literally show Claire writing and then like going through the computer, and then there'd be like actors, and then there'd be like actors playing Smokey and Hart in her fanfic, so they'd have to like cut them in, or almost like in Harry Potter with the scenes with the pensive. I don't think it would have as much of an impact. Yeah, well, I think we get to know Claire better and Forrest better than we could have in a movie or TV show, because we get all their exposition, and I think without it, it'd be difficult to see how much they're struggling to come to terms with who they are as people.
But, asterisk, because if this gets adapted, I am so here
for
it. Oh,
I'm watching it.
I recommend this book if you like thinking about fandom in general. It gets pretty meta, as our conversation all throughout this episode has shown. I also recommend if you like shipping, obvi.
Yeah, I recommend this for fans of Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell. I mentioned that in the beginning, but I think you'll really enjoy Claire attempting to make her ship canon. Kath from Fangirl and Claire from Ship It are very different characters in different situations, but I think that fans of Rowell will enjoy this too, because we do see like characters in both the books trying to come to terms with who they are. Kath is trying to come to terms with who she is as like her fanfic is ending, and she's like being kind of like separated from her twin sister as they go to college, and Claire is trying to just figure out who she is as a person. So Fangirl's great. Read it if you liked this, and if you like Fangirl.
And if you want a book that'll make you cry in all sorts of beautiful ways.
And laugh. It was so funny.
It was funny.
It's embarrassing to be, like, I work at a library, so sitting up at the front desk reading and, like, laughing out loud. It's embarrassing. But also, like, sorry, not sorry.
You'd do it again.
Oh, my God, yeah. I'd do it 1,000 times again.
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post your tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for the book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on the podcast app of your choice. And if you're feeling benevolent, we'd appreciate it if you would rate and review the show, particularly on Apple Podcasts. See you in a fortnight.